Caucasia had chosen Haggis over Yusheng Rosa. Charlie continued his mute oversight of the fields. A breathtaking planting of kohlrabi lay below them. A complicated bedding scheme of dwarf sunflowers seemed to be turning their shaggy heads to follow the sun, trying to share in his admiration of the plentitude of nutritious crops. Shasta continued to look on. Only then did the reality of the situation strike her. Her arrival here, at this spot, at this particular moment in time, was no accident. As the sun ticked its way across the blue Caucasian sky, each sunflower twisted its bright orange face, like a stadium crowd moving in perfect unison to perform the wave. The rows of sunflowers gradually came to face Shasta. Looking past the thousand pregnant laborers, beyond the ripening kohlrabi, she could recognize the secret of this moment. A glance at Charlie confirmed her suspicion. A faint smile flickered on his lips. Where his eyes fell, the emerging shades of orange formed a pattern. In contrast to the lighter lime green of ordinary produce, the sunflowers began to form words. Emblazoned across a mile of open country, legible only from this lofty vantage point, the crops turning to face them spelled out the message, "Charlie, heart shape, Shasta." Whatever it was that entered the room, its skin glistened. The creature shimmered with hazy waves of scent. The scent of every coconut in the world split open. The stink of piña coladas uncountable. Knotted shreds of red bandana gathered its wiry hair into apparently random clumps. But the bulk of its oily frizz burst from its head in a mass so dense, the hair pushed its ears forward until each stuck out like a handle on a pitcher. Its bare feet shuffled into the parlor. They hopped and capered. Whatever made its way toward Jamal, it loped. A length of hemp rope held up its tattered pants and the ragged cuffs flopped against the floor. It advanced across the parlor in jerking strides, waving its arms in torn shirt sleeves and stretching its pleated turkey neck to gawk at the furniture and paintings. In this manner, it crossed the Persian carpet, goggle-eyed and smacking its raw lips. "Lordy," it cried, "that Miss Josephine never permission my to enter no parlor." The apparition held out its elbow at shoulder height, displaying soiled white gloves worn on twiddling fingers. With each step, it jerked each knee so high, so fast, it might have been wading through glue. A muscle spasm seemed to seize its face, forcing the eyes so open that a wide margin of whites showed around each iris. These eyes rolling in every direction, while the mouth yawned to display gleaming teeth and the chin wagged side to side, jutted forward one moment, and the next sunk back into the neck. The bare feet, the scrawny legs, visible through rents in the trousers, the neck and face of the creature, they were all coal black. As the thing capered forward, Arabella looked on from her station near the doorway. "Mr. Jamal," she said flatly, her eyes looking elsewhere, "this is Barnabas." She sighed heavily. A soiled glove thrust itself at him. With swollen, cracked lips, the Barnabas thing sang out, "I's pleased to meet you, Master Jamal. Y'all don't know how much. That Miss Josephine, she was the devil woman." Jamal exchanged a glance with the housekeeper. Arabella shrugged. She lifted a hand and idly examined her fingernails. Black as oil, blacker than what people call blue black, the Barnabas thing continued to prance spryly in the center of the room.
"Why, that devil Miss Josephine, She keep me locked in the attic for most of my whole life.
Jamal puzzled through its Butterfly McQueen diction. He looked to the housekeeper for a tell, any cue, but she'd buried her face in both hands to stifle a laugh. Clearly, whatever the nature of this demented gollywog, the joke wasn't on him. Reluctantly, he brought his gaze back to the head-bobbing, hip-shaking grotesque. Barnabas? He asked. Can you tell me where Miss Josephine's gone? The eye-rolling creature brought both gloved hands up to frame its wrinkled face and trembled as if cowering in terror.
She done gone skedaddle to Caucasia.
Arabella cleared her throat, winced. Jamal looked her way.
Barnabas, she said, nodding toward the creature, has been living in your attic, sir. He's the noise you've heard nights.
This news wasn't unwelcome. As of lately, a fear had begun to trouble Jamal. The idea that he'd done his life's work too early, by participating in Adjustment Day and rising to the lofty lifetime rank of Prince of Blacktopia, he might have peaked too early. The rewards, this manse, the wealth, were pleasing, but as the Talbot Book decreed, property is but the residue of true accomplishment. Adjustment Day hadn't settled his spirit. On the contrary, that achievement left his soul hungering for greater challenges. From here on, he was determined to live a life of deeds instead of objects. As the Talbot Book dictated, only the impossible is ever worth doing. No man who'd taken part in Adjustment Day, whether he now be a prince or a chieftain, took anything for granted. Jamal knew from the forfeiture records that the owner, this fabled Miss Josephine, had never surrendered the title to this property. No record existed of her relocating to or applying for compensation from Caucasia. Long and hard, he looked at this jabbering, spry monstrosity. Minus the burnt hair, the ragbag ensemble, and impossible obsidian hue of its skin, this had to be her. The housekeeper's head-shaking and suppressed amusement confirmed as much. The old lady, clearly deranged, she puffed her cheeks and whistled a jig as she slapped time against her skinny thighs and bopped around the elegant room. The whistling and bopping ceased, and the creature stood bug-eyed before a tall oil painting. The portrait showed a whiskered military officer in Confederate grays, bedecked in gold braid, a sword lashed to his side. After more than a century, his blue eyes still blazed with resoluteness. The creature sucked its teeth, ducked its head, and squinted sideways with theatrical venom at the picture.
"Master Jamal," it said, "can I ask you something?"
Poking with one dirty white index finger, it asked,
"Is you planning to burn these devil pictures?"
Jamal met Arabella's surprised look, matching her single raised eyebrow. "Why, Barnabas, would you like me to burn them?" The Barnabas creature bared its gleaming, two white teeth and tentatively growled at the painting. When the man in the picture didn't growl in return, Barnabas raised one white-gloved fist and shook it at the officer.
"I's been prisoned in this house my whole time on this earth."
Jamal struggled to decipher such gibberish. Each utterance was a test. The Barnabas creature squinted with menace and peered around the room, pointedly taking in the crystal chandelier, the rosewood grand piano, the marble fireplace and velvet upholstery, every tassel and brass battoon. It puffed its pigeon chest and flexed its chicken wing arms as if ready to throw punches.
"If and you ax me," it muttered, "I thinks you should burn down the whole house." Jamal leveled his gaze on the poor creature.
Barnabas, he said, have you considered that your animosity was the reason Miss Josephine never trusted you? Maybe it was time to move beyond the off-the-rack, ready-to-wear political ideology of Talbot. Maybe, Jamal asked himself, he should hold on to this problem to see what insight it might yield. Barnabas balled his gloved fingers into fists and took a boxer stance.
Why's you side with Miss Joe?
Jamal wasn't fazed. From Wiggers to the film 10 starring the actress Bo Derek with her blonde hair braided in cornrows, to white Trustafarian young people with dreadlocks, this Barnabas seemed like the inevitable result of cultural appropriation. An old lady Wigger, the latest in a series of chemically enhanced Sambo types, the racial equivalent of a drag queen's botched version of being an actual woman. Jamal flashed on the fictional character Dorothea Wilson in the much-beloved Tales of the City novels by Armistead Maupin. As a failed fashion model, a white woman named Dorothy had blacked up and become a successful, highly sought-after black model. Sickle cell anemia was the punchline in the book adored by millions. That and the issue of Superman comics titled I Am Curious, Black, where the intrepid reporter Lois Lane uses a device to transform herself into a foxy black woman for 24 hours. Whether they called it reporting or research, for white people crossing the color line was always just fun and games. It might even prove to be a pathology, like multiple personality disorder or gender dysmorphia. Per Harvard psychology professor Dr. Jeremiah Brockyard, racial dysmorphia or transracialism was demonstrated by the activist Rachel Dolezal, who posed it being black, and by the singer Michael Jackson, who took huge health risks to appear more white. As Sigmund Freud had made his career with the case study of Dora, Jamal might just as easily exploit the mental illness of this demented white lady for his own fame and fortune. Here was his next challenge. Jamal raised a hand to signal the housekeeper. Arabella, would you be so kind as to bring my guest and me two extremely cold mint juleps? If this apparition was the manifestation of a shattered, disassociated personality, or it was some form of Stockholm syndrome brought on by finding herself an alien in her former nation, Jamal didn't venture a guess. Not yet. It dawned on him that this, adventures like this, peopled by flawed, damaged characters, were the stuff of books. In this Barnabas creature, his own book might be born. His would be a book written by a black man about a white woman pretending to be a black man. The title wrote itself. His literary masterpiece, he would call it Black Like You. In the seasons that followed Adjustment Day, the beaver population rebounded. As the human population seethed in disarray, cities becoming scenes of famine, not just beaver numbers surged. Otter, bobcat, muskrat, and rabbits all made a comeback. Minks and lynx and wolves. As the weather flushed the toxins from the environment, even the apex predators, such as bears and panthers, rebounded. Fur was everywhere. Consequently, artificial furs emerged as the new status symbols. Minus the now defunct petrochemical supply chain, fake fur and leather were rapidly becoming extinct. A standing inventory of fake furs winked out. No new fake furs replaced them. Thus, to flaunt his wealth, Chieftain Charlie did don robes of chartreuse leopard and rare acrylic zebra. He strutted the corridors of his palace in knee-high boots of endangered naga hide. His courtiers arrayed him in capes of lime-green faux sable and fringed gauntlets of pleather studded with costly ersatz pearls. Thusly adorned, He mounted the battlements of Maryhill to survey the rich plantings of sugar beets and sweet onions, the arabesque bedding schemes of acorn squash and endive, the wealth of his kingdom. Shasta had taken her leave, but soon she would become his consort. They would be wed the moment her genetic testing confirmed her ethnicity. A voice spoke. Charlie turned from the battlements and the view, and his eyes fell upon a liveried footman. The man escorted a young maiden, a home wife from among the staff of scullery maids and chambermaids. No beauty was she, but her loins appeared sound. He nodded his approval, and the footman escorted the girl away. She would be waiting in his apartments when he was ready. A stink had begun to saturate the basement. The source of the reek was the old man's blood, because even blood sours like milk, and the stench of discarded blood had given its flavor to every breath Walter drew. Black flies had circling Walter and Talbot, circling their half-eaten food in a constant miasma, as if the smell itself generated a low hum. Not the best custodian of his own hygiene, Walter had given short shrift to the needs of his elderly ward. Meals sat too long at room temperature, the stink of their decay undetectable in the room's overall stink, the result being that Talbot's toileting had become sudden and explosive. With every tainted inhale, Walter had assured himself that people had done worse for a fortune. To date, every task Talbot had set was a test. The big picture would soon snap into sharp focus. Once the list was posted and had drawn its first submissions and votes, Walter had waited for the next challenge. His new old man had been dozing. His head had drooped, and he jerked awake with a single bubbling snort. Sputtering his lolling head on his thin neck, he'd muttered, "Hypnagogic spasm." He'd gone on to explain. Between wakefulness and sleep, people pass through the hypnagogic state, a phase when sleepwalking occurs. Also common are hallucinations, visions of tripping over an obstacle or falling from a window, and the sleeper jerks awake. That sudden awakening, sleeper experts called it the hypnagogic spasm. Anthropologists, according to Talbot, believe that our evolutionary ancestors had developed the spasm to guard against their losing grip on branches or the fur of the mother primate. Our vision of falling is their vision of plummeting to the jungle floor, a terror left over from before we were human. Talbot had expounded on the concept. He'd swallowed hard and licked his dry lips. His chest had risen and fallen like a bellows, swelling and collapsing the lacerated little dirigible of his ribcage. Not all the corrupt food had been shed out, as demonstrated by the vomitus that spilled down the old chin and clung in pale clots to the gray chest hair. "You know N.A.?" he'd asked. He'd meant the 12-step group for recovering drug addicts, Narcotics Anonymous. He'd said, "Go there." Here had been the next phase of Walter's training. Talbot had demanded, "Find me one man or two with nothing to lose." Walt was to hear their stories and listen for men who'd given up on life, younger men, angry and disillusioned men. Talbot had wanted recruits who'd turned to drugs because they were smart and strong, and the present world offered them no outlet for their gifts. These would be men who hated drugs, but hated more a society that had left them with no means to achieve the status that all men crave. Walter was to promise them $1 million. He was to promise to make each man a prince of the new world. Walter hadn't liked the sound of that, seeing how he hadn't himself gotten one red cent. To bide for time, he'd picked up a bowl of cold top ramen and given it a cursory sniff. He'd closed the steps to where Talbot sat duct taped to the chair. Using a spoon that managed to feel both greasy and sticky, He'd shoveled the noodles into the gaping old mouth. His tongue crowded with food, Talbot had cited the American civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. Prior to it, the dispossessed and powerless had gone to churches for comfort. And in those, the disenfranchised had discovered they weren't alone in their misery. United, they'd formed an army, and the church leaders had recognized their power and led those armies into battle. Choking and sputtering, Talbot had said, "Those groups, recovery and support groups, are the new churches." He'd said that traditional places of worship had been reduced to crass theaters where people went to signal their status and virtues. A true church had to serve as the place where people went in safety to risk confessing their worst selves, not to boast and display their pride. Those who attended recovery groups, they arrived defeated. They told the story of their failure, their sins and shortcomings. To admit their culpability, and in doing so, they receive a communion with their flawed peers. It was in these unlikely churches, in the company of the drunkard and the dope fiend, that Walter would find the officers of his new army. The greatest armies in the world are destroyed by idleness, Talbot had argued. Without opportunity, the men Walter would be enlisting, in the absence of an external enemy and a battle, they were becoming casualties of themselves. What Talbot was to tell Walter, Walter was to preach to these men he himself selected, and those men were to venture forth and spread the message to a small number of men. If those men are queer, beguile them with visions of Geisha, where they could live in their own homogeneous company. If white, testify to them about the future possible in Caucasia. If black, offer up the promise of Blacktopia, where they need never kowtow to any other race.
"Bring me," Talbot directed, "your learned helpless."
His voice rose to a shout.
"The wretched results of jobs offshored. Lend these, the hopeless, diversity vanquished to me."
Whereupon Talbot had appeared to swoon. In little more than a whisper, he'd uttered,
"I'll foot the bill. The world is yours."
And once again he'd fallen into a jerking, restless, fitful slumber, filled with prehistoric terrors. As the Talbot book put it, the disunited states had always been a nation composed of nations. Some sovereign, others invisible. Parishes, guilds, associations, chapters, and clubs. After Adjustment Day, those that were self-sustaining survived. But those dependent on the largesse of the vanished government or on the fawning attention of the vanquished media, those brotherhoods and alliances ceased to exist. The same went for families. The two brothers had agreed to meet for lunch. To meet for one last time. A billboard dwarfed the small roadside diner on whose roof it sat. Easily twice the size of the eatery, its bold black lettering read, "Whites Only." Inside, the two men sat in a booth beside the front windows. They sat facing each other like imperfect mirror images. The same nose, the same eyes and mouth and ruffle of hair, both leaning with elbows on the table, but each with a different expression. A server wearing a checkered gingham frock and an apron with scalloped edges stood over them. Her pen poised above her pad, she recited,
"The soup du jour is Paula Deen white bean stew. For specials, we have Richard Spencer 8-ounce whitefish filet and an all-white meat Lester Maddox chicken salad."
One of the brothers noticed her waiting. "Give us a minute, okay?" That was Esteban. The other brother said, "We'll have two Paula Deens to start with." This was Xavier. When the server had stepped away, Esteban reached into a pocket of his jacket and took out a handful of white packets. White plastic little pillows no larger than before times credit cards, heat-sealed along all four edges. He tossed these into the center of the empty table. In black felt-tipped pen, some packets were marked with a lowercase p, and some with a lowercase d. Esteban nodded at the packet, saying, "You don't have to emigrate." Xavier reached to examine one. He squeezed its softness between a thumb and index finger. "They're black market," Esteban explained. "The D stands for drool. Squeeze one into your mouth if you're facing a racial test. It's lab-certified European-derived saliva." Xavier poked at a packet marked with a P, asking, "And these?" "Piss, for urinalysis," Esteban said. "Don't get them mixed up." Xavier pawed through the packets. "Your handwriting is piojoso." Depending on the viewing angle, the P's and D's were identical. Undeterred, Esteban said, "Stay here in Caucasia, so we can visit. I have diplomatic immunity. As a member of the First Lineage, I can travel freely between all three nations for my job." His brother regarded the packets, turning them as if trying to discern which was which. The twang of country western music played on the sound system. Beyond the windows, a mix of motor vehicles and horse-drawn wagons moved along the highway in both directions. From the highway, a great expanse of red cabbage filled the acres that rolled toward the horizon. Looking into that distance, Xavier asked, "Why do you do it?" Esteban squinted at the packets. He slid one away from the rest, saying, "I think this one is piss." He slid another aside, saying, "But this is drool. I think." He stopped his fussing abruptly. "You have no idea," he muttered. Louder, his voice steady, "Nations are founded on religions. They're founded on political systems, abstract ideas. Why not something as real and basic as sexual preference?" Xavier didn't offer a rebuttal. His duffel bag sat slumped on the seat beside him. "I wanted to help," Esteban continued, "to create one safe space where people wouldn't feel like outcasts." A ring interrupted. The sound came from inside a pocket of his jacket. He took out his phone and studied the screen, saying, "Lofty affairs of state beckon." He got to his feet and exited to the parking lot. "Two white bean stews?" a voice asked. The waitress slid two bowls onto the table where Xavier still waited. She glanced out the window to where Esteban stood talking on his phone. The bowls, brimming with steaming muck, had pushed aside and hopelessly scrambled the poorly labeled packets. She stood watching Esteban outside, asking, "Haven't I seen him on television? Is he somebody?" Conspiratorially, she asked, "You know if he's married or not?" Xavier watched his brother giving orders, muted by the window glass and the background of traffic noise. The server wasn't leaving. Smiling, he turned to her and asked, "You know your music sucks?" Even as she turned in a huff, he was already tearing open packets. It didn't matter, P's or D's. With the server gone, Xavier got busy mixing all the lab-tested European-derived whatever into his brother's bowl of soup. Considering what Talbot had said, the irony hadn't been lost on Walter. If recovery groups were the churches of this era, they were still conducted in the old church buildings. As Christian churches had commandeered the temples previously devoted to Apollo and Diana, The local chapter of Narcotics Anonymous met in the basement of St. Stephen's. In the above-ground sanctuary, bathed in colored sunshine from stained-glass windows, the good citizens wore their Sunday best. They sang in the correct key in harmony and recited their prayers in unison. Beneath their feet, underground, it was another story. Away from the sunshine, after sunset, an entirely different congregation shuffled in. Fragmented, solitary. Instead of incense, the smell of cigarette smoke wafted off them. In place of sacramental wine, they drank black coffee and took communion with jelly donuts. It was only his excitement about Shasta that had gotten Walter into the church basement, about seeing Shasta's face when she realized he was rich. Talbot had coached him that creative visualization wouldn't cut the mustard. When an outfit like Amway wanted to motivate rookie enrollees, it encouraged them to test drive Maseratis and Alfa Romeos. People were encouraged to shop for Gulfstream jets and contact real estate agents for tours of mansions on fairways and private beaches. Real details motivated people. The smell of leather seats and the sound of ocean waves under the bedroom windows. People needed to know the fine details of the life they were striving to achieve. Vague goals such as good health or money were too difficult to measure. The abstract doesn't excite the spirit, but the softness and warmth of a sable coat, or the glow of a diamond necklace, the silky feel of the perfect saltwater swimming pool, these motivate. And so Walter had pictured Shasta aboard the sailboat in San Francisco Bay, and he added the scent of her suntan lotion and the taste of the Chateau Lafitte 1869 they'd drink. Someday they'd nibble beluga white caviar and laugh about the measures Walter had taken to make his fortune, about flaying Talbot with razors and posting the list and invading Narcotics Anonymous in search of converts. Bolstered by these specifics, Walter had ventured into the netherworld of this new religion. There, parishioners had arrived dragging their crimes, with names like Clem and TJ and Keyshawn, wearing business suits, wearing track suits or stained coveralls. They'd waited their turns, men and women, to make their full confessions. There, away from the world, each had given an account of his or her worst behavior and had resolved to do better. To whom to offer the world? Which man to radicalize? Walter had listened, weighing the out-of-work veteran against the barista struggling through beauty school. Talbot had warned him. The whites would blame the blacks. The gays would blame the straights. The blacks would blame the whites. And everyone would blame the Jews. Walter had waited, as everyone had had his or her say. Talbot had told him exactly what to say, and had forced him to repeat the words until he'd known them by heart. When everyone had spoken, it had been his turn, and only when all eyes had fallen upon him had Walter said his piece. "My name is Walter," he'd said. Another day, another test. He'd imagined the smell of Shasta's terror as she stood kissing him in a house he secretly owned. Before the group could stop him, he'd announced, "I'm looking to recruit men who'd rule the world in less than a year." A collective groan went up as people had scoffed and shook their heads. "Anyone interested in being a founding member of a new ruling class? Please see me outside." And Walter had stood up, and he'd excused himself, and he'd stepped out the door, walked up the stairs, and he'd waited in the alley for a hero or a fool, or for no one to follow him. Charm flipped through the pages of a cookbook, passing over the recipes, but lingering on full-color photographs of lobster Newberg and Waldorf salad. She studied cannelloni, feeling her mouth fill with saliva. She ogled bok choy to the point she might have to swallow, then rushed to the kitchen. Her mother stood over the stove stirring something in a frying pan. She wore a wimple. A wimple. She was so white, her lips stretched as thin as pink rubber bands. Gavin was the lucky one. Shasta, too. Shasta should just surrender for export to Blacktopia. Charm and her parents were trapped, condemned to the patriarchal gun-toting Renaissance fair that was Caucasia. Her mother looked up from her cooking and said,
"Hello, dear,"
Charm asked.
"Beer? It's early."
Her mother was sipping from a tall mug of amber liquid.
"This?"
she asked, offering the mug. "It's urine. Prevents cancers. Black people swear by it." Charm hummed a response. Her mouth was too full of spit to risk words. She opened the refrigerator and took out a plastic tub. Hand-lettered on the snap-tight lid was the warning, "Hands off, Charm's drool." She peeled off the lid and tipped her face over the tub. A thick, cloudy liquid sloshed inside, and she hawked a nasty loogie into the mess. Her mother winced.
"Disgusting."
She tipped back another swig of medicinal urine. Charm spat again and snapped the lid on the tub. She'd been at this for a couple days, and the tub still felt empty.
"Science fair," she said. "Pavlov's dog."
Her mother leveled a worried look at her.
"You know science is off limits."
The moratorium, she meant. The big push to get anyone into STEM careers was dead. The edict was that white people were supposed to be breeding instead of reading. As she closed the fridge, Charm tried to change the subject.
"I've been thinking about Gavin."
Her mother's brow pinched. She feigned confusion, asking,
"Who?"
"Your son?" Charm went to the sink and filled a tall glass with water. All her spitting had taken its toll. Her mother sighed as deeply as the lacings of her bodice would allow.
"We have no son," she said.
"You have no brother." As she drank the water, Charm weighed the statement. Was her mother cruel or just being a realist? Once Gavin had immigrated, it was unlikely they'd ever have contact with him. The best they could hope for would be a surrogate son or daughter exported by similarly disappointed parents in Gaysia. Too many parents took offense. If their children reached the age of declaration, 18, and announced an inappropriate sexuality, it looked like betrayal. Charm knew her own parents had asked Gavin to postpone his declaration. People could wait until they were 19, and delaying this announcement would have given them 2 more years together as a family. But Gavin, he'd filed his paperwork. He'd known what he wanted. He wanted to get the hell out. Her mother didn't meet her gaze, but continued to stir, saying,
"You know you can't go outdoors like that."
Whatever was in the pan, it hissed and spat. She meant bareheaded. Women of Caucasia were required to cover their heads in public, another measure intended to instill ethnic unity. Hence the wimple. French Tudor caps were tempting fate. A girl might as well sashay around topless. Snoods? Forget it. Charm knew her parents had already lost one child. God forbid their remaining child get bounced into a heretic's work farm or whatever. The school had called today. The principal was threatening expulsion. Her mother pinched up some salt from a bowl and sprinkled it into her cooking. She said,
"They claim you chased more boys with your exposed lady parts."
Using both hands, she twisted a pepper mill.
"Those young men were awfully shaken up."
Charm smiled at the memory. She'd panicked the varsity basketball team during practice by leaping out of the girls' locker room with no pants on. She'd stampeded a crew of alpha males out through the fire exits. Alarms had sounded. As feminist power moments went, it felt pretty glorious. She was already trying to work up a new mouthful of spit.
"You think Gavin might be in trouble?"
What she meant was that the nation of Gaysia had only recently launched its program to reproduce exports. It would be 17 years before it yielded any heterosexuals who could be traded for the homosexuals stockpiled in Caucasia and Blacktopia. At that rate, Gavin might be 34 or 35 before he stood a chance of emigrating. Of course, some do-gooders might raise the half-million Talbot dollars needed to ransom him, but the odds seemed slim. Not for all the teenagers in retention camps. All the while, the heterosexual nation-states would already have babies in the pipeline, and over the next 17 years, a small army of queer exports was going to get bottlenecked at the retention camps. Straight folks had a history-long head start at the baby-making game. As her mouth filled, Charm watched her mother and tried not to swallow or speak. Currently, nations conducted a modest back-and-forth trade in babies born with a majority of Caucasian or sub-Saharan DNA, but everyone knew the real bonanza would be in the export of misborn queer citizens. That was the new term, misborn. It denoted anyone born and raised in an inappropriate nation-state. Furthermore, who knew if Geisha would prioritize the youngest exports? Otherwise, more generations would spend their youth waiting to be repatriated. If younger exports were given priority, then Gavin could spend his entire life trapped in limbo between two nations. His letters didn't say as much, but Gavin himself had stopped writing about his high hopes. Whereas he used to write about finding love, settling down, and becoming a force to help build his new queer nation, lately, he'd taken to complaining about the camp food. It was lousy. Starchy beef stews, watery vegetable soup. The same way that illness became the chief topic among the elderly, Charm knew that food was the main preoccupation of people in prisons. None of this she mentioned aloud. She just watched her mother stir. It was fried chicken, the grease popping. Potatoes boiled in a pot. Dinner rolls were baking in the oven, and the butter had already been set out on the countertop to soften at room temperature. Her mother reached up and pressed a switch. The hood above the stove began to hum, and the steam from the fry pan spiraled upward and disappeared. The smell, so much fat and meat, the Parmesan cheese she knew would be mixed into the cornmeal breading, the aroma flooded Charm's mouth with new saliva. In another minute, she'd need to open the fridge again. Her brother was a hostage, and the faster she filled that plastic tub with spit, the sooner she might liberate him. The callers weren't Clem or Keyshawn, but they spoke with the same brusque economy of words, demanding, "Get Talbot!" On those occasions, Walter had clipped a hands-free phone to Talbot's scabbed head and retreated from the room. At Talbot's urging, he'd begun to type his notes into a single comprehensive document. To what end? Walter hadn't a guess. It might have been a book in progress, or it might have been just a new test. Beginning with the first test, flaying his new old man in search of a make-believe homing device, keyboarding his notes was a walk in the park. The men he'd enrolled, Walter had only been able to speculate about. The two heroin addicts. They might be tooling around, living large on Talbot's dime. They might even be spreading the gospel of Talbot to their fellow junkies and support groups across the country. Not impossible was the idea that a network of desperate men was branching and spreading out to cover the nation. Or those two men might be dead. Nothing about Talbot's disappearance had ever surfaced on the news sites. Again, it was pure speculation, but the police might have kept the entire situation under wraps pending their investigation. That said, the FBI might have been closing in at any moment, staked out down the block, ready to batter down the front door. Walter had kept typing. Talbot's shouts had summoned him. The old man had said, "You need to make the call we talked about." Walter went to take the phone off the old spotted scalp. Leakage. Drops of blood swelling from old wounds had glued it in place so effectively, the ear clip hardly seemed necessary. The gruesome truth was that Walter had to peel the phone off the stretching, sagging old skin, and even then the black plastic was speckled with tacky smudges and crusty scabs. So much so that Walter had been compelled to scrub it with an antibiotic wet wipe. All the while Talbot had harangued him. "Tell them the code," he'd groused from his chair. "Don't keep the connection open longer than 1 minute." Walter had sniffed the phone. It had smelled like nothing but rubbing alcohol. He'd punched in the number he'd learned by heart. A voice had answered, a woman's voice. "Senator Daniels' office." Walter had eyed the old man, saying, "I'm calling on behalf of..." The voice had cut him off. "The senator's in a meeting?"
10 seconds, shouted Talbot.
Walter had taken the nuclear option. "This is a code 4C247M. The connection had gone silent for an instant before a booming male voice had come on. "This is the senator," the voice had announced.
"Yes."
Walter had gone on watching Talbot for any signs of approval or disapproval.
"You need to introduce the War Resolutions Act?"
Talbot had explained the situation, how the youth bulge of surplus males threatened to destabilize this country, as well as any number of foreign nations. The act would catalyze the induction of 1 million young men into the military, and these men would be pitted against equal forces conscripted in other countries. It wasn't lost on Walter that whenever events in the world went south, it was always men his age who'd be dispatched to clean up the mess. Walter had told the senator, "Mr. Talbot would like the war to commence no later than the opening day of grouse hunting."
"Of course," the senator had said.
Unless Walter had been mistaken, the man had been panting for breath as if he'd sprinted to reach the phone. Talbot had explained that a world war would reduce the surplus of labor. The global manufacturing markets would explode with growth. Finally, Walter had imagined he could see some big money at the end of this very long tunnel. He told the senator, "Mr. Talbot sends his best wishes to your wife."
"Of course," the senator had said.
30 seconds,
had barked Talbot from his chair. Tipsy with power, Walter had baited the man on the phone.
"How is Mrs. Senator?"
The senator had hesitated.
"She's fine, sir."
To date, Walter had never been addressed as sir, and it felt surprisingly good. Before he could lose his nerve, he'd given Shasta's full name and asked the senator to expunge her parking tickets.
1 minute! Talbot had snapped. "Hang up!"
As one last mocking jibe, Walter had asked, "Senator, when is grouse hunting season?" His voice reedy with stress, the senator had asked,
"This year?"
"This year," Walter had confirmed. "It begins 1 day after the onset of World War III," had said the senator, adding, "Sir?"
Only then, with the test complete, with Talbot glaring bullets at him, taking his own sweet time, did Walter hang up. One evening stood out among the many Jamal spent tipping back mint juleps and trying to study the creature. In its indigo-black hide, he could discern traces of the aged Belle who'd burnt her hair to a frizzed mess and daily strutted down from the attic, high-stepping and animated with Bojangles, jazz hands, and leering minstrel show faces. Times the creature would drop its act and reminisce about the people depicted in the portraits. Those times, the shuck and jive erased by gin, the creature would hold forth about the cemetery that lay on the far side of the field. Jamal would tour among the gravestones, big and small, and the creature would narrate about the lives of one and all. Examining each grave closely, Jamal asked if there was one for a woman named Belinda.
"That bee's in the slaver section," said Barnabas.
The creature walked to a wooded area outside the family graves. There among the rusted crosses and sunken gravesites, Jamal found a small stone, the white marble eroded by rain. Only the name Belinda was legible. On other occasions, the creature would fall silent and Jamal would read aloud from the Talbot book, that gospel of the new, new world. In the parlor with a fire crackling on the hearth, he'd read, "We love to fight, but hate to win. We challenge authority, create conflict, and pit ourselves against power, not because we want to dominate, because we know triumph only means more fighting. We love to fight, because we know that whatever irresistible force finally defeats us, we can rejoice and recognize that enemy is God." He'd noticed how when the creature was drunk and playing a fool, it seemed to experience genuine joy. It raised its cracked voice to belt out old spirituals. Jamal observed this with a mixture of pity and fascination. This strutting clown. It had manifested as a haunt. The spirit of this forlorn place. The sight brought to mind more from Talbot. To whites, the most enviable quality of blacks was their capacity for happiness. They exhibited a graceful determination and good nature that whites could only covet. Over centuries of persecution, blacks had evolved an enviable spirit and inner delight. To ruin that joy, whites created the grievance industry and poisoned black happiness by replacing it with rage and hatred. By sowing insecurity, whites have destroyed the greatest power blacks once enjoyed. By teaching blacks to take offense, whites have succeeded in cursing blacks with a misery far greater than any white unhappiness. As it slumped in a red velvet chair, the creature blinked surprised eyes. It smacked its swollen lips and asked,
"Master Jamal, that book, do we really say that?"
Jamal nodded. The creature nodded in return.
"It sound right."
Lost in thought, the old eyes studied their own reflection in the polished side of the silver julep mug.
"Master Jamal," it asked, "does your believes in God?"
Jamal was a little loaded. He answered, "I love what God creates, but I admit I don't give him the credit." Leaning closer to the creature, he added conspiratorially, "If I'd said prayers half as many times as I'd been online looking for porn, I'd be saved. No doubt about it." He smiled roguishly. "I only wish I loved God half as much as I love some of his beautiful, beautiful creations." Whatever it was, the creature seemed to understand. Just then, it could have been what it was. An old white lady in blackface afraid of being turned out of her ancestral home. Seeing the creature's face soften, a truth struck Jamal. His worst fear was that the stooped freakish gnome would resolve itself. It would revert back into a frightened old lady. The woman would leave this house and take with her its history. His concern was about more than writing his book. Jamal would be alone in his power, a king in a castle, but without his ridiculous jester. This capering, ludicrous buffoon was the only person in his new life he felt comfortable around. He'd never anticipated that power would be this lonely. No one would ever believe the word of this fool, so he could confess any secret to it. How badly he needed this lunatic as his confidant, it scared him. He wondered who needed whom more. To stem the moment, the king reached to a pitcher that sat sweating on a side table. Without being asked, he poured the creature's drink full. Delicious poured herself another glass of wine. It was safer to look drunk than to look scared. The police wouldn't arrest a tipsy woman, but they'd follow someone who smiled furtively and walked down the street too fast, staying in the shadows and looking away when passing headlights revealed her face. She checked her makeup in the bathroom mirror and touched a smudge of lipstick off one front tooth. A knock came at the door. "Just a sec," she said. Her wine glass sat on the ledge beside the bathtub, next to the empty wine bottle.
Perfume. She almost forgot. A dab behind her knees, a dab behind each ear. She downed the glass of wine, then reached up under her short skirt and wiggled the panties down her thighs and tossed them into the clothes hamper. A last look in the mirror gave her confidence, as did the wine. Opening the bathroom door, Delicia said, "All yours." Waiting in the hallway was Felix. He was Belle's boy by her husband. Not that Gaijin law would recognize such a union. Nowadays, Delicious's man Gentry was playing house with Jarvis, just as Delicious had wed Belle in a grand public ceremony in the stupendous cathedral of Harvey Milk, with a release of hundreds of white doves and a 24-piece orchestra at the reception. Felix had served as ring-bearer. Felix knew what was at stake. One slip-up, and any one of them might be detained as an export. They'd be placed in a retention center and eventually relocated to Blacktopia or Caucasia, never to be reunited with his or her beloved. To make matters worse, now they had Felix to worry about. He wasn't like other boys. At an age when he ought to be lip-syncing to vintage Gloria Gaynor mixes, he was staring a tad too long at the scads of women they passed in the street. He didn't seem the least bit interested in dating other boys, and it worried his mother. She insisted he was merely going through a phase. Weeks shy of his age of declaration, she begged him not to openly flaunt his heterosexuality. At the least, such risky behavior would get him bashed by self-righteous thugs. At worst, he'd be deported. That would be the last either of his parents would set eyes on him. Felix gave Delicious a smirk. "Don't you look hot," he said, his eyes taking in her smooth legs, her feet wedged in high heels, her hemline high and her neckline low. He smiled his approval at her new weave and the smudge of glitter in her cleavage. "Date night?" He nodded at the empty wine bottle in one of her hands, the empty glass in the other, her long manicured fingernails. It was. Date night, that is. But not with his mother, Belle. Delicious ignored the boy's leer and pushed past him. "Don't you have a circle jerk to attend?" "Nope," he shook his head. "We had a big sperm drive at school today." Delicious knew he wasn't kidding, but didn't hanker to hear the details. She took her purse off the foyer table and checked inside. A certified letter had arrived that afternoon. With it safely inside her purse, she headed for the apartment's front door, saying, "Tell your mom not to wait up." Felix was nobody's fool. He knew the lay of the land, calling out, "Don't get busted." On the street, Delicious strode through the night. She relaxed in the warm air and allowed her hips to roll, pushing her skirt higher the wider she stepped. Bystanders, mannish types, wolf-whistled their praise. Flannel-outfitted females growled compliments in her wake. A police car pulled alongside and matched her speed, and she dared not look in its direction. Despite the wine, she knew the fear would show in her eyes. She could hear the radio chatter. A generation seemed to pass before the cruiser switched on its flashing lights. Here and now, Delicious knew she was caught. Her imagination spun the scenario. The Gaijin police had staked out her apartment. They'd been monitoring her movements. She'd be deported. The red and blue lights washed over her. The car siren wailed. Tires barked against the pavement, and the cruiser jetted off in response to another call. Her legs weak with terror, Delicia stumbled through a dark, unmarked doorway. It was a dive. Pre-adjustment day skin magazines, dog-eared, wilting in wire racks, depicted healthy all-male and all-female sex acts. The covers bore titles like Sapphic Clam Diggers and Greek Butt Pirates. No one wanted these vintage wank mags from some bygone disco era. These were set dressing, a front. A brooding skeleton of a man sat on a stool behind a counter. She paid him a few Talbot dollars for a handful of metal tokens.
secreted behind the magazine racks, hidden in back of the dusty glass cases displaying pink dildos and VHS tapes. There a curtained doorway opened onto a dim corridor. Delicious parted the stiff fabric and stepped through. The smell of sex was pungent, and she stood in one place while her eyes adjusted to the dark. Her footsteps on the sticky floor made peeling sounds. This place, the tawdry underbelly of Geisha. Here people indulge their illegal appetites. Swimming in murky black light, the numbers 4 and 7 and 13 seemed to hover before her eyes, before she realized they were splashed on in a stroke or two of fluorescent pink paint. These and other numbers were placed at regular intervals, each marking a peeling, splintered door. Movement caught her attention. A blonde man, his teeth glowing, said, "Hey, chocolate lady." Men and women, black seeking white, white seeking black, all heterosexuals, all illegal, they lined the dingy hallway, some exposing themselves in the hope of enticing a sex partner. She lifted a hand and flashed him her wedding ring. He flashed his own. She continued along in that rank, crowded space. Splintering doors opened onto closet-sized cubicles in which same-sex adult films flickered on streaked video screens. Delicious chose a door bearing the number 10 in day-glow paint. Used condoms littered the floor. Condoms, or worse, stuck her heels to the floor, tugging to pull the shoes from her bare feet. A plastic chair layered with corruption stood in one corner, and she considered sitting before remembering she wore nothing under her skirt to protect her. She stepped inside and shut the door behind her. The video screen glowed with two astonishingly attractive men, one black, one white, copulating romantically beside a luxurious swimming pool outside a regal mansion. In Geisha, race mingling was permitted, but gender mixing was not. A knock came at the door, and a male voice whispered, "Hey, chocolate lady." Irked, Delicious cracked the door, ready to curse some amorous stranger. In the dark corridor stood a stooped figure. Not the handsome stranger who'd accosted her earlier. This man was familiar. She grabbed him around one thin, pale wrist and dragged him into the cubicle. Once they were both inside, she shut the door and blocked it by wedging the filthy chair beneath the knob. Every surface she touched felt either sticky or greasy, and she wiped her hands on her skirt. Even then, her mouth was seeking out the man's. Her hips were grinding into his. His hands were roving over her, sliding up her legs to discover her wet readiness. Without prompting, her knees buckled and she squatted low. Her hands fought to yank his slacks down his slim hips, and her lips sought the opening in his boxer shorts. Her lush mouth didn't give a thought to repercussions before they were committing one of the most heinous crimes known in Geisha. The result should have been immediate, but his manhood failed to respond. She worked it with her hand so she could ask, "Gentry, baby?" Her husband groaned softly. "I can't." Delicious spat on her hand and kept at it. "What's up, baby?" High above her, Gentry's face was shadowed and indistinct. "We had an extra sperm drive at work today." He was referring to the collection of viable sperm from all male citizens of Geisha. It was voluntary, but not.